Well, thank you very much for that introduction. It's pretty much as I wrote it, really. I am grateful for the acknowledgement that I'm struggling a bit with ill health. I have come back with some bug and was lying on my couch yesterday morning. I was telling Loetje when she rang, watching sunrise, and there the ticker tape news said Tim Costello's suffering with dysentery. And I jumped off the couch. I thought, is that what I've got? It's not, and the doctor hasn't diagnosed that, but it's a bit funny when you see your bowels being discussed on the news. I decided I was definitely going to watch the Channel 7 news at night to see if I was going to recover. But I am here, and it's a great pleasure to be here to honour my long and old friend, Loetje O'Donoghue. I want to begin with acknowledging the Kaurna lands and the First Peoples of Australia, to acknowledge also tonight Bill Cossey, Chair of the Don Dunstan Foundation, Vice-Chancellor Michael Barber, Deputy Vice-Chancellor Fred McDougall, the Honourable John Vendusa, Chancellor of the University of Adelaide, the Honourable Jay Weatherhill, representing the Premier, and Robert Lawson, representing Martin Hamilton Smith, Leader of the Opposition. So, to all of you, distinguished guests and men and women of Australia, to coin a phrase. It indeed, I think, for all of us is a great honour to be here in Reconciliation Week. It's the 41st anniversary of the 1967 referendum and, of course, the first anniversary of the Loetje O'Donoghue oration. I think rhythms and celebrations and memories are really important as we struggle to take these issues seriously. I feel great joy that the Don Dunstan Foundation has named an annual oration in the name of Loetje O'Donoghue. Loetje said at the first oration she would be much more relaxed during the 2008 Loetje O'Donoghue oration, knowing that someone else would be giving it. I wish I was feeling as relaxed. Well, as the recipient of that handball, I certainly want to honour the quite extraordinary work that Loetje has achieved, and I think it was put well by our MC tonight, opening the door. I think we forget that those who have gone before, above all, had to have courage, extraordinary courage, to see things, to state them, to name them, when others didn't really see them at all that way. Loetje was one of those people. Don Dunstan, one of our most remarkable premiers, was another one. As you know, Dunstan had enormous courage. He sought to devise and implement just policy for those on the margins of society. So with these two names, we, whether it's Indigenous or mainstream Australia, are immeasurably richer because of their wisdom, their compassion and their courage, because of their commitment to justice, respect and social inclusion. Now, anyone who wants to speak about Indigenous affairs knows that too easily we line up on a simplistic spectrum. Either we say one believes in Indigenous rights, that's the core of dignity, and that's where I stand, or you believe in personal responsibility, and that's where you stand at the other end, as if these are two opposite, fixed, intransigent positions. Of course, in dogmatic worlds of varying orthodoxy, we prefer to know where people are on the spectrum. We've done our due diligence, we can tick the box, know if they're left or right, or muddling and weak middle, whether they're progressive or regressive, symbolic or practical, pro-dogma or post-dogma. But I think most of us know life is always more complex. And tonight, rather than that two-dimensional spectrum, I want to think of the reality of viewing these issues as looking at it through a multicoloured prism, using one of many different lenses to understand the Indigenous whole. And because it is the shadow of our European-Australian story, to understand our own soul, our own struggle, our own journey to be healed. To do so says that rights and responsibilities aren't polar opposites. They are deeply entwined. That those who seek to separate them are inevitably left with a glass half empty, or perhaps worse. I believe reconciliation produces a wholeness and dignity, and that those who can think in these terms can move toward it, can leave the dogmatic spaces where they have maybe felt secure, knowing who their mob is in the left or the right, but have been left impoverished. Certainly for World Vision, this has also been a journey for us as an organisation with our own Indigenous people. 1973, because we're largely an overseas aid agency, it was Indigenous church leaders who came and brought the plight of Indigenous people to that organisation's attention. Since then, we have been establishing networks of relationships with individuals, community leaders, saying, how do we work with you? How do we support your leadership? How easy it is for white Australia to say, well, if only Indigenous could get it together. I can't find too many white leadership groups that have got it together. If only they'd speak with one voice. I don't know too many white groups that do that. I say it's really important to say, we will support Indigenous leaders. We will stand with them, knowing there are differences, knowing there are huge debates going on at the moment, and knowing that it is our duty to say we are standing with you, supporting you. If we're religious, praying for you, encouraging you, saying we know this is difficult and we don't have the answer. Too often we've had this U-Butte problem-solving approach, and we've completely missed the moment and stuffed it up. So for World Vision, this has been our approach in a wide cross-section of involvements with Indigenous Australians. From the people of Wetunga, a remote community in the Northern Territory, where I was late last year, to groups in Armidale, south of Perth, an urban community in Western Australia, where we're doing skills training, from artists across Central Australia to members of the Koori community in metropolitan Sydney, World Vision programs with these communities have focused on backing their leaders, building capacity, seeing social enterprise, youth, health, governance as all the pathways to reconciliation, and all of them need leaders that are Indigenous, that we stand with and we back. So we are committed, I guess, to a long-term development approach, working with communities, working with participatory methodologies to identify issues, to repair, to rebuild a local Indigenous sense of community and leadership, and to encourage far greater levels of involvement in whatever the development process is. But having said that, this always involves ambiguity. It's not some romanticised sentimentality of here's the cavalry who've come to help with our solution. It's fundamentally about this is your life, your aspiration, your community. What do you want in terms of employment and education and empowerment, particularly from the mainstream? So as a result of sitting down and listening to Indigenous voices, we have certainly discovered what most of you here tonight already know. The past injustices have massively impacted on Indigenous families. Much of the dire poverty, the poor health, the high unemployment, the poor education, the domestic violence, the imprisonment rates, the lack of self-esteem, track back to unjust policies. We know this in World Vision terms globally. Where there is lack of access to justice, there is poverty and there is internal violence. Access to justice and just policies are fundamentally important. But we also, in World Vision, continually draw strength that exists in communities, in Indigenous leaders who, like Loitcha, have risen above their history of experiencing injustice. To move through Australian society with great dignity, with great grace, with forgiveness in their heart, to lead a journey of healing. That is the richest gift they have offered. Now, as I've said, there are no quick fixes. If any of you here tonight have some, please see me after this oration. I don't have any. I don't have any. But we certainly believe that addressing any one issue in isolation is not going to solve the problems. We are fundamentally suspicious of magic bullets in Indigenous affairs policy. Everyone, it seems, has an opinion when it comes to Indigenous affairs. Too few are prepared to hang in there, working on a number of levels in the long haul, working and listening and empowering. Well, let me talk about the post-sorry environment. Now 3 months since the Prime Minister apologised to the stolen generations with the words, "That this apology be received in the spirit in which it is offered, as part of the healing of the nation." I was in Geneva when the apology was given at the World Food Programme with Europeans and Americans, because it had been a huge story on CNN and BBC. Many in the UN and the World Food Programme grabbed me, some with tears in their eyes, and said, "This is extraordinary leadership. This is 21st century leadership. We wish our leaders could speak like that. Tell me about this story in your country." I can say I was never, never more proud to be Australian. So, Kevin Rudd said since the apology, "We now, as a government, want to focus on the priority of closing the gap in health inequality." As you know, I've arrived back a week ago from the south of Myanmar. There, I have discovered how awful it is when you have a malevolent government, how incredibly frustrated I was seeing my Burmese workers, some 600 staff, working night and day, going down to the Irrawaddy Delta, taking tarps, rice, clean water, medicines, in tears, knowing that they weren't getting through to enough people because of the military roadblocks. And time again being told by the military, "Just leave your aid here, we'll distribute it for you." I went and met a general in a hall almost as ornate as this, and pleaded with him to say, "Please give us a letter to get through those military checkpoints. A letter that says we distribute the aid, not the military." And to my surprise, I got that letter. That was gold. That made a huge difference. Only now, some 25 days on, are some people starting to get the aid they should have got within a day or two after the cyclone. It is awful. And the frustration and the impotence and the guilt, knowing that you can do the job and save lives and they're dying because of the government stopping you, is just terrible. It is just terrible. But having come back from seeing so many Burmese as pawns in the political play of the Burmese generals, it is a shock to realise that in Myanmar, the average male life expectancy is 58 years, whilst here for Indigenous males in Australia, it's even less than 58 years. To think that we have a patch of Myanmar with a very, very different government in our backyard brings to me the brutal reality that this is the most morally profound issue for Australians to address and solve. Well, as in Myanmar, the way forward for NGOs like us is through socio-economic development. Education and employment are the keys. Of course, Indigenous people need and want also assistance in those areas, but not of the type that is dogmatic or prescribed from afar. I've found that the door is open to people with the necessary expertise that are prepared to commit for the long haul, to build the necessary trust and familiarity that has driven effective practice in the past. Now, perhaps this may be counterintuitive to some, but this was a key characteristic of productive relationships that formed during the mission and station times. And they will be fundamental to the journey of healing in the future. One of the women that Loitcha and I both know, Sister Eileen Heath, who was the best friend of my aunt. She's now 102. She was there at Magumba River when the kids from Rabbit Proof Fence escaped. She went to Alice Springs and ran St Mary's there. She still has, at 102, all the particular missionary views of that time. But you would be hard-pressed to find someone who isn't loved by Indigenous people and loves them as much as Eileen Heath. I'm sure Lois would agree with me. Yes, there is a whole lot of ambiguity around those times. But also, in the journey of healing, it's important to recognise that many productive relationships were formed in those times. And then NGOs that want to play a role, an enabling role in this local space, can learn something from that in terms of staying, of long-term engagement, of knowing this is about saying you are significant. At the end of the day, what every human wants to know is, do I matter? Do I matter to someone else? Only by staying, only by long-term relationships that are mutually reciprocal, do you sense that. So these relationships are important for those who want to engage in the business of Indigenous affairs. Now, the National Apology has helped immeasurably to create this enabling local space. When on February 13th this year, the crowded galleries of Parliament House, the packed lawns outside, from Federation Square to Martin Place, to schools and workplaces across the nation, Australians listened to the Prime Minister say these words: "The time has now come for the nation to turn a new page in Australia's history by righting the wrongs of the past and moving forward with confidence to the future." That received tremendous public support, greeted with gratitude, pride, and oh, so many moving tears. And it was so much more than symbolic. This was our nation's truly historic National Day of Healing. This will be looked back on as a moment when our hemorrhaging psyche had pressure applied to it to stop that hemorrhaging, to say at last there has been some morally serious business done. Prime Minister Rudd captured the spirit of the occasion. "The Parliament is today here assembled to deal with this unfinished business of the nation, to remove a great stain from the nation's soul, and in a true spirit of reconciliation to open a new chapter in the history of this great land, Australia." Bold and momentous words. So it is with some trepidation that I now contemplate this new chapter in the history and healing of our nation, beyond sorry. Well, the first thing to say that I don't think I need dwell on is there has been a breakthrough in public awareness that we have to close the gap, that life expectancy now between Indigenous and non-Indigenous is the issue, that non-government organisations have spearheaded this Close the Gap campaign. So when Prime Minister Rudd spoke of closing the gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians on life expectancy, he included educational achievement and employment opportunities as dimensions to that gap. This is an important distinction to highlight, lest the policy response be dominated only by health interventions. The gap is all of these areas beyond reach. Now, very briefly on health, there's a very well-established link in the public health literature between health and well-being, health and life expectancy. Socioeconomic conditions are a crude measure of well-being, but it's the best one we have available from the statistics. International development experience that World Vision works with has demonstrated that you have to view socioeconomic status in relative, not absolute terms. It's now more than 10 years since Richard Wilkinson published his book, Unhealthy Societies, The Afflictions of Inequality. Through an international comparison of population health, he concluded that life expectancy is higher where differences in income are smaller and where societies are more socially cohesive. Wilkinson showed that the key is not poverty in absolute terms, but relative terms. Now, social inclusion is, of course, an issue that affects all Australians, but it's particularly between white and Indigenous Australia that the income differentials are huge. Between Redfern and the eastern suburbs of Sydney, between the town camps and the adjacent mining town of Newman in Pilbara, where the differences are acute. If we are to bridge the gap in life expectancy, we have to bridge the gap in socioeconomic status, especially with education and employment levels. Just a quick look outside our nation. The life expectancy of Indigenous people in Australia is much lower than of Native Americans, in the order of about 10 years. While we can explain away the difference in health between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians in terms of historical and political disadvantage, how do you explain the differences in health between Indigenous Australians and Native Americans? Both groups are marginalised minorities in their own land. Both have endured a history of dispossession of land, loss of culture and language, and forced separation from families. When you compare the statistics between Native Americans and Indigenous Australians, what stands out is the difference between employment and education. The level of employment among Native Americans in the US is twice as high and three times as high if CDEP employment is excluded. Three times as many Indigenous people in Australia have either not attended school or not finished grade 10. The percentage of university graduates is 1/8 as great. The level of home ownership is less than 1/3. So, clearly, the relative socioeconomic disadvantage of Indigenous people in Australia is much greater in comparison to Native Americans in the US. And we know the US has great inequality. Let me talk to property rights and home ownership. One of the important socioeconomic indicators is home ownership. I played a role in the 2020 summit. Our stream was strengthening communities, supporting families and social inclusions. In the lead up to the summit, I spoke publicly about a rent-to-buy scheme and federal government giving assistance to particularly our kids who won't get into the property market to actually move from being renters to buyers with some different financial mechanisms and legal title mechanisms. I have a self-interest in this. I have three kids who are aged 25, 22 and 21, all still at home. I'm doing it just out of my own needs here. But I do know that home ownership is such a powerful determinant of prosperity in this country. Taken from a perspective of social inclusion of marginalised groups, the interesting thing about home ownership is the extent to which it determines socioeconomic status in the mainstream. The thing we casually roll off our lips, the great Australian dream, is a very, very powerful thing, especially if you are the first in your family's history to be included in it. For instance, Marpoon, the west coast of Cape York Peninsula, a discrete Indigenous settlement, approximately 200 people, established by Moravian missionaries at the end of the 19th century for the Presbyterian Church. It was at first occupied by people from the Indigenous groups from the immediate area, people on whose land it is occupied. Later, Aboriginal children from across Queensland who'd been removed from their parents were brought to Marpoon, as well as some Torres Strait Islanders, some South Sea Islanders. So, Marpoon people, including those not presently living in the community, possess a strong, disparate but collective identity across their traditional, historical and ethnic diversity. During the first 27 years of the operation of the mission, the Reverend J.N. Hay adopted an unusual approach to community development. Newlywed couples were encouraged to settle several kilometres south of the mission station along a strip of estuary and river known as the outstation. Small cottages were built on plots of about 5 acres, with subsistence farming lots and plantations of coconuts. Outstation was spatially separate from the village, with its own church and graveyard. Rather than being absorbed into the mission coffers, wages earned by men working in the fishing and pastoral industries were used by them to purchase corrugated iron and other building materials for their houses. Reverend Hay went so far as to petition the Queensland Government to grant secure title over the blocks of land to the resident families. Through the 1950s, the Queensland Government began to question the viability of the Mapoon settlement, for reasons, really, that were wrong, highly contested. And so people were forcibly relocated to other settlements, including New Mapoon on the tip of Cape York. Some refused to leave. In 1963, the Queensland Police removed a small party of people identified as the leaders of the resistance to New Mapoon. Houses were burnt down during the removal. All except one that weren't burnt down were demolished the next year. This removal incident became known as the watershed political event in Indigenous history in Queensland. Here were Mapoon people actively discouraged from returning to their lands and to houses that they'd built, earned money and loved. And their spiritual connections were cut off. Of course, with the relaxation of government controls through the late 70s, people began to re-establish contact with their country. And what did they do? They went back to building their houses on the original mission blocks. As the return to Mapoon was not supported by government funding, families relied on their own skills and ingenuity, on their own wages, on the building materials they could salvage. The sweat of building their homes during the mission period, their subsequent demolition by the Queensland Government, is remembered with both pride at what they achieved and resentment at what the government did. With the return to Mapoon in the 70s, people immediately camped on the same block where their homes were located during the mission times and, as I said, built their new buildings. These bush timbers, second-hand materials salvaged from the Comalco dump in Weipa, and I have it on good authority that rubber conveyor belts make good flooring material. These were good houses. They are often quite elaborate in their construction, and they dominated housing in Mapoon right up until the mid-1990s. Then some people moved to some newer rental houses. Well, recent policy moves towards home ownership in remote settlements have captured the attention of media and the Australian public. But home ownership, I want to say, had long been a reality for Mapoon people, and a source of pride and a source of organising and resistance. And all of this occurred with the active facilitation of the church. Now, I'm not here tonight to say there's a magic bullet called home ownership. There's some blanket policy solution there. But I certainly think it would be feasible in some communities, in traditional communities also. As in Mapoon, where there is history and existing aspiration by people to own their own homes, I believe it should be supported. The level of home ownership on communal title lands and reservations in the USA are of the order of 70%. I don't know why it should be so difficult here in Australia when it happens overseas. A third response in terms of moving on, the journey of healing. Less complexity and more stability. We have been served another reminder recently on the state of the deplorable condition of child welfare in remote settlements. This time in the Anangu Pitjantjatjara Yankunytjatjara lands by Commissioner Ted Mulligan. In the preface to the report, he asserts, prior to the mid-1970s, the life of the Anangu on the lands was generally healthy, peaceful, safe and content. There was an effective system of social order, law and governance, and mutual responsibility. During the 1980s and 90s, life changed drastically for the people and, sadly, for the children. Mulligan seems to be stating that life was better during the mission period, prior to self-determination policies in the 70s. This statement, at least in a qualified way, has been publicly supported by our learned colleague, Loachira Donoghue. This is remarkable commentary of the lack of progress in governance over the past 30 years, of good intentions, of even investments from state and federal governments, but of going backwards. For the past 15 years, a member of the World Vision Australia team has been working and visiting the remote settlement of Doomadgee in the Gulf of Carpentaria. People in Doomadgee echo the views of Loachira that life seemed to be better during the mission time. This is a major shift from the 1990s, where the mission was blamed for all the ills. As I say, life under the mission wasn't necessarily good, but some are saying it was slightly better. Of all the mission regimes in Australia, none was stricter than Doomadgee. Christian Brethren deployed a particular strict doctrine, symbolic in the ankle-length frocks worn by the women. But also important during this time was the links that operated with the outside world through the pastoral industry. The mission was established considerably later than other missions in Queensland, and by this time Doomadgee people had long contact with the region's cattle stations and towns. The mission was quick to capitalise on this pre-existing local expertise, and Doomadgee became a labour pool to the pastoral industry. The rest of the story, sadly, we know. In 1965, close to 300 employment agreements were signed for Doomadgee workers in 74 pastoral properties across Queensland. The Doomadgee mission itself was divided into a number of fence paddocks, which were stocked with small herds of cattle, mainly for self-sufficiency purposes, but also to provide a useful training opportunity for young men before being sent out to work. When people talk about this time of the mission and stations, two common elements emerge: a daily routine and structure around meaningful work, and important long-term relationships they formed with trusted outsiders, who were mostly non-Indigenous, employed by the missions and stations. Thus, employment and governance relationships provided important entry points for people to participate with dignity into the Australian society. And then, of course, the fair wage case started to affect those discoveries of engagement. Well, if we were to contrast this to the current situation found on remote settlements, high levels of unemployment, the meaninglessness of many CDEP activities, high turnover of outside staff, fly-in, fly-out visits of government workers, we all know the trusted outsiders are essential to the workings of local governance in remote Indigenous settlements. They are in international development settings because the external system is so important, and it collectively constitutes Indigenous affairs, which is exceedingly complex. All of us know how it's not uncommon for 20 different bureaucrats from 20 different government departments to visit a remote Indigenous settlement in 1 week. Believe me, there's nothing like that occurring in the villages of Myanmar. Pragmatically, however, in order to deal with this quantity of administration in practice, you have to employ outsiders with knowledge, networks, to navigate the complexities, the externalities involved. The nature of the problems faced in local governance are such that neither Indigenous nor non-Indigenous groups can fundamentally find solutions on their own. We understand that at World Vision because we're trying to work in this space, brokering this governance space across Australia in a number of Indigenous communities. So to increase governance capacity, there is a need to reduce the administrative workload. Less complexity, more stability in the external service system. In the words of one Aboriginal leader, "We are climbing the ladder, but the ladder's growing faster than we can climb." We argue at World Vision that participation in governance is fundamentally important as a socio-economic indicator. It's like home ownership. It's an important way to close the gap. Well, we have to challenge the status quo in Indigenous affairs, and from our experience, that is largely about the way the problems have been conceptualised and solutions offered. There are so many experts in Indigenous affairs, but the solutions inevitably lead to another program, which usually means more complexity. Whatever the pros and cons of different policy solutions, the reality in remote Indigenous settlements meanings take shape through relationships that form locally, extended, trusted relationships. So it's important to start with the realities at the coalface of Indigenous affairs. Otherwise, policy solutions are fired into administrative vacuums, just ideas without any real capacity to implement them. Maybe beautiful ideas, but without engagement from the intended beneficiaries, these beautiful ideas are dumb ideas. If we can go beyond blaming individuals, religion, politics, culture, then maybe it's time to say that there is no solution, that the system has become so overwhelmingly and hopelessly complex in its pursuit of finding a solution that it itself has become the problem. To the extent that the system is workable, it's in the capacity, innovation and adaptions that work locally, with long-term trusted outsiders. Yet trusted outsiders sometimes are dismissed as gatekeepers and Aboriginal leaders as corrupt elites, the guardians of a culture that must change. Policymakers ignore the local practitioners of their policy. Then on what basis will they measure the efficacy of intended outcomes? There is an urgent need to understand the conditions of successful practice at the coalface, where you implement it. This is the engine room of Indigenous affairs, not the rooms full of well-meaning people in Alice Springs and Canberra. Well, I've gone to some lengths to emphasise the need for socio-economic development. I don't want to gloss over the injustices. They are real and must be addressed. Time is running out, so I was going to talk about stolen wages and the fundamental injustice of that. Let me move on from that and go to my last point, time for a treaty. Australia is the only major former British colony in the world never to have negotiated a treaty with its Indigenous inhabitants. As a result, Indigenous Australians have never had a binding legal document to fall back on in order to assert their rights or to challenge the actions of governments. I believe that a treaty between the federal government and Indigenous Australians needs to be negotiated to prevent Indigenous rights being eroded. Such a treaty would bring Australia into line with other countries, New Zealand, Canada, and the United States. The process of getting to a treaty would encourage open and honest debate that I hope would lead to a better understanding of the need for a treaty between Indigenous Australians and the federal government. A treaty would succeed under circumstances where a basic framework agreement is proposed by a broad section of Indigenous Australians and where Australians see it as a natural flow-on from the apology, which was an extraordinary historic step in healing. And if you think these are rather radical ideas, let me finish by saying one of my great heroes, William Wilberforce, was advocating it back when he was fighting for the abolition of slavery. Wilberforce, who founded what came known as the Clapham Sect, a very devoted, optimistic group of Christians, some in Parliament like Wilberforce, some outside, who literally looked at social wrong and said, "We have to change it." And when they changed one thing, they said, "Now what else can we change?" They had this restless energy that wouldn't stop. Wilberforce chose the chaplain for the First Fleet, founded the New South Wales Benevolence Society, the oldest benevolence society in Australia, fought then against convict transportation, fought for the rights of Native American Indians. Wilberforce was a champion of prison reform, labour reform, and the Clapham sect under him had one in their group, a barrister called James Stephen. Wilberforce had rescued him from a suicidal depression. And Stephen's son, also called James, a member of the Clapham sect, became the permanent undersecretary for the colonies from 1836 to 1847. He is regarded as the greatest civil servant of the 19th century. It was he who drafted the legislation outlawing the slave trade. He was so influential, he was referred to as Mr. Over Secretary Stephen, King Stephen, and Mr. Mother Country, more powerful than the Prime Minister. It was Stephen, with his responsibility for English colonies, who decreed, in conjunction with working with Wilberforce, that the Indigenous people were to be protected and that the principle of racial equality maintained. It was Stephen's ideas that saw the protection of the Maori in New Zealand incorporated into the Treaty of Waitangi in 1840. The Wilberforce evangelicals had been in power by the time we all settled, they were just a generation later, we would have a treaty. It's as simple as that. So, with Wilberforce, with Stephen, we know that Australia would not have been a terra nullius. Ideally, whatever framework agreement is reached, it would need to be enshrined in a legal instrument to ensure its safety. A Bill of Rights, a constitutional amendment. Either way, it is likely that a referendum or a plebiscite would be required. Now, we all know about the failure of referenda. A major obstacle to public support for a treaty was the insistence of the previous government that treaties can only be negotiated between nations. But it is obvious that Indigenous gains made overseas, whether in relation to land rights or reparations for stolen children and stolen wages, have all been the result of treaties. When delivering the inaugural 2005 Mabo Oration, Noel Pearson said the principles established by Mabo were the best opportunity for resolution of the colonial grievance between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians. He declared it a cornerstone for reconciliation legally, politically, historically and morally, not simply a legal doctrine relating to real estate. Mabo, he said, was an overarching moral framework for reconciliation. Now, whilst I agree with Noel that native title is critical to reconciliation and economic development, we now all know the processes in place to resolve outstanding native title claims are overly complex, exceedingly slow. This is why, whatever those words about Mabo, I would actually take them from Noel and apply them to what a treaty might do. It would be a treaty that could build and codify and enshrine property rights and other rights for Australia's First Peoples. Addressing the past injustices, whether it's stolen wages, which I left out, the signing of a treaty are important aspects to creating the enabling framework for socio-economic development to occur. We are, however, under no illusion that the hard yards still need to be done, need to be walked, that the coalface of working of communities, building on strengths of relationships between leaders and trusted outsiders, still has to be done. That long-term relationships so critical in the early days of missionaries and station workers need to be replicated, with present-day employees of Indigenous NGOs, Indigenous organisations and NGOs. In the 60s, when Aboriginal stockmen went on strike at the Northern Territory Wave Hill, led by Vincent Lingiari, they walked off the job and set up a camp at a place called Waddy Creek. The dispute over wages and conditions turned into a demand for land rights. We all know the words from Little Things, Big Things Grow, immortalised in the Paul Kelly and Kev Carmody song. I want to finish with them today, saying that the small ways of grassing innovation, what happens at the coalface, actually is fundamentally important to closing the gap in health, in inequality, in tackling the gap in education, employment, home ownership and governance capacity, in saying there are no easy policy solutions, and those who say there are maybe have created the big problem, that we have to work this out locally in practice. But let's take hope. As you can see, whilst there is much to be done post the apology has turned the rudder on the ship of state and given Australians a desire to bind up the wounds which the apology was in part responding to. It is as if we have started out afresh on a journey of healing, and I commend all of us to take that journey in whatever way we can. to start with our little things, and out of them some big challenges I have outlined will be sure to grow. Thank you.